Okay, so tonight we're gonna shift gears. And if I could find my slides, there we are. Now we're gonna spend the next 2.5 hours, roughly, modest breaks, talking about certificates, trust, and PKI. So I'm gonna ask you to kind of not forget the past N lectures, but take your mind back in the Wayback Machine to when I last talked about protocols. Because every time I talked about protocols, I kept saying, how do you know that you trust somebody's key? And we deferred the problem. And I said, just assume for a moment. So tonight we're going to talk about how do you know that some key that comes to you over the net actually belongs to the person that you want to believe it belongs to. And so to start with that, we'll talk about certs. And that's coming up. And let's remember, sort of as motivation, the SSL scenario, right? So I go out to Amazon, and I decide that I'm going to go, you know, buy some books, or whatever it is they're selling today, that's cheap, or what have you. And I set up this SSL connection, and how do I know that the party at the other end of that server is really Amazon talking to me, as opposed to, you know, some man in the middle here, which we always call Mallet, right, who's playing both sides of that. How do I know that the key, that here I am, I'm sitting here on the client, and I'm doing the SSL handshake, and if you remember, the SSL handshake basically is this three-stage protocol where the client sends a message to the server, you know, hey, let's talk securely, here's my cipher suites I want to talk about. The server says, okay, let's use RSA with SHA-1 and an RC4 stream cipher, and here's my public key, and here's some stuff to convince you of that, that it's my key. And then the client sends back, okay, here's a session key encrypted with that RSA public key. And what we're going to talk about tonight is what goes here, and that's some other stuff, okay? And we're going to dive deep into what goes into the certs, and you'll probably learn more about those data structures than you wanted to, but it's important to understand kind of how these things get constructed in practice, and a lot of the practical issues with deploying public key infrastructures come down to, you know, how these things relate together. So what's that some other stuff? So you'll remember I put this slide up last time, and I said, well, you know, how does Bob convince Alice when he sends a key to Alice over the network that that key is really Bob's key, right? Well, they can meet in the parking lot and exchange keys directly, but that's not really practical. Someone who Alice trusts could vouch for Bob's key. All right, so let's say you're Amazon, right? What you do is you go out and you get somebody that everybody in the world's going to believe to certify that your key belongs to you. And we'll talk about how those parties exist. But the key thing here is a third party certifies the binding between a key and a name. And that, at the end of the day, is sort of the fundamental thing that's going on in PKI. So that's what a cert is. At a high level, all a certificate is it's a digitally signed statement that binds a key to some identifying information, and it's signed by an issuer. So the key people here are the issuer and the subject. So there's an issuer who's the person that signs the statement, and there's a subject key and a subject name or some other information, and it's a binding between those. What the issuer is doing when he signs is he is standing behind the binding, and the issuer is saying, I, as the issuer, assert, or, you know, swear, but not really swear, but assert that this key belongs to the party identified by this identifying information. Now, that's a really nebulous statement I've made there, because depending on the scenario, the type of identifying information is going to be wildly different. And what's going to matter in the context is wildly different. For example, if I'm issuing certificates for email in an S-MIME context, what do I care about mostly? What's the identifying information I'm going to bind to keys? The email address. If I am doing SSL, what am I going to bind to it?
The company that owns the
host name. DNS name. In some cases, and actually it gets a little bit more complicated there, because if I'm running a web farm, I may actually bind a wildcarded host name. I could actually choose to bind an IP address, but nobody really does that anymore because the machines move around too much and load balancing. Okay? And in fact, it costs more money to get a certificate with a wildcard in it than one without, because you're covering a wide variety of machines. That's the current business model.
From the
popular people that sell certs. And I'm not going to talk too much about business models tonight, although we can certainly get into that if you have particular questions. But certs are a really nice business. I mean, you generate an RSA signature, you sign a little thing, you send $2,000 a day back and charge somebody $400 to $800 for it. It's a really cool business, you know?
What's your liability in such a business?
Ah, that's a really interesting question. If you look at some of the certificate practice statements, your liability is about none,
yeah,
or very limited, okay?
It's interesting to analyze the insurance they give you because the likelihood of them messing up on that contract is almost nil.
Not nil enough. Okay, I will give you two examples where it was not nil. It is public knowledge that in fact a large CA, the largest one kind of in existence, accidentally issued some code signing certs for Microsoft that
sure.
found the Microsoft that weren't belonging to them.
But they cover that. Their insurance policy doesn't cover them. As far as I understand, doesn't cover them fraudulently issuing.
Their practice broke out, but here's another case. So, in fact, this happened within the last week. There is a little bank out in Salt Lake City called, like, Mountain America Bank or something like that.
Credit Union.
Okay, somebody registered some domain name that looked very similar, and they owned the domain name, and they registered a company for it, and they went on and they got an SSL cert. And GeoTrust, which is another CA, actually put a cert out for them. Because guess what? You own the domain, you want to put a server up.
Yeah.
And you now had effectively a name collision because somebody put up a phishing website for the bank and they weren't the bank. It's like if I went and I put up bank-of-america.com or bankoamerica.com and people didn't kind of recognize,
that's
you know.
The thing is that what they do is their policy is so strict that they only say, I will never falsely validate a certificate for a domain that doesn't belong to that certificate.
This gets a little bit more. I'll tell you what. Why don't we hold this off for a bit until I get down to the PKI section? We can talk about what you actually look at because it's a real good point. And it introduces this nice little quote from Bob Blakely: "Certs are like marriage, which means sometimes they go bad." So at NDSS, Bob Blakely actually got up and he took like Tim Polk, one of the guys, I heard the story secondhand. At NDSS, is one of the big security conferences, and he took Barb Fox, who was the old security architect for this sort of stuff at Microsoft, and he stood her next to Tim Polk and said, "By the power vested in me, I declare this text and this bit string name and key. What RSA has joined, let no man put asunder." And that's kind of what certs are, okay? Right? They're binding these things together. Let's talk about some real world examples. Whenever people talk about certificates, they immediately dive into the driver's license example. And everybody, of course, wants to come up with, well, certs are no different than all these other credentials you carry around the real world. That's not really true, and we'll see why throughout the day why it's not quite. But let's give folks the benefit of the doubt first, okay? Driver's licenses are kind of like certificates. They're signed in the sense that they are a tamper-resistant form, and actually now most of them have some sort of digital information on it that we presume is signed, you know, has some digital coding. It's created by an issuing authority that may or may not be trustworthy. It's certainly trustworthy for certain purposes and accepted for certain purposes and not others, right? The driver's license that I get from the Washington DOL is enough for me to show the nice police officer who pulls me over when he thinks, you know, I'm going too fast. And it's enough for me to go buy alcohol at a Washington State liquor store. But it doesn't help me go buy alcohol at a Massachusetts liquor store because Massachusetts only accepts Massachusetts IDs, for example. And it's not enough for me to get across the border because the trust policy at the border doesn't accept a driver's license, or it won't anymore. I have to have a passport, right? So I have a credential that's issued by an authority that's good for a certain set of policies, but not everything, okay? And the acceptance policy is just as important on this, okay? But it's issued. There's a question here.
But to work like one of these certs, wouldn't I have to look at your driver's license, call the DOL, and verify that license number is good?
We will get to that. That's a very good question. Now, a certificate in and of itself, if it's a signed document, and you know the signer's key, you can cryptographically verify that. And then we will get to another, later on tonight we're going to talk about revocation, okay? Now, when the cop pulls me over because I'm driving too slow in the left lane, okay, which is the only time he'd, of course, ever pull me over because I'm driving too slow, right? And he looks at my driver's license, and he calls it in, he is doing a real-time status check, okay? And we're actually going to talk about some of the differences in that later on, so hold that thought, okay, until we get to revocation. But you're right, but if I walk into a bar and I get carded, Okay, it doesn't happen much anymore, okay? But let's say it did. And I show my ID. They trust that ID in and of itself. They look at it. They try to flex it. It doesn't come apart on them. They kind of think it's sort of intact, right? And they believe that it's integral. I don't get carded much these days, okay? It's kind of fun when it happens, you know, but it doesn't happen much. But they kind of look at it, right? When I show it to the TSA person to get on the plane, they kind of glance at it and they say, oh, okay, it matches the ticket and they let you through, right? Different people have different trust acceptance policies on it, and a lot of times, they just trust that, okay? Now, depending on the value of the transaction, okay, how much thought you put into that changes. If I go to Target and I buy something on a credit card, I shove the credit card in the machine, it scans it, it never even looks at the signature. I could write, this is an invalid card on the back, and they'd never know the difference, right? If I go to other places, like Fry's always demands that I show a photo ID with my credit card these days, because they don't trust any credit cards, I guess, in and of themselves. Different acceptance policies, okay? And that really varies on the amount of risk. If you try to use a credit card to go buy a car, they're going to do a lot more credit check on that than if you're using it to, you know, go buy a DVD, because the value at risk is different. Okay. That's a bit of a digression, but it's a really important point. And all the things that we're talking about here, it's not enough to think about one factor is what the cert's issued for underneath the issuer's policy, but the way it's going to get used in the acceptance policy is just as important. Okay. When VeriSign, for example, issues a cert, they can put certain limitations on their liability in it. They cannot prevent you from accepting it beyond those liabilities, beyond those restrictions. So, for example, let's say I'm a CA, and I hand you a cert that says this is a cert that's good for email only, and you're not allowed to use it for anything other than email. And you go and use that cert to do something else with it, okay? Now, depending on the mechanisms that we'll talk about a little bit later, policy may refuse to accept that, but you can't come back to me. If you rely on a cert, I issue a cert that says this is good for email only, and you rely on that coming from a user to do something else, and that fails, you can't come back at me at the issuer. I'll say, hey, you did something outside of what I bound, what I attested to. All right? So in all of these, there's really three parties always involved. The issuer, the subject who was given the cert, and the relying party who's going to make some trust decision on the basis of that information. And always keep in mind that there's three parties involved. It's not really a two-party system. And in fact, there's usually N parties involved, because as you'll see, it actually gets a little more complicated. Anyway, that was sort of a long-winded example. I talked about sort of all these other types of certs that we have in the real world. Licenses, the tabs on my car, various IDs, my Costco card, the fact that the FCC gives me a certificate once every 10 years that says I still have the rights to November 1 Tango Juliet Tango is my amateur radio license. That's a physical piece of paper that comes in the mail. All I have to do is send a form and then say I'm still alive, and they send me a renewal. It's really quite nice. And I get a cert. I get a physical cert, which can be photocopied and shown to a lot of people, right? That they exist. And it's good for, what's that good for? That's good to prove exactly that I own, you know, some amateur radio license. And the Washington State DOL accepts it as proof that I'm entitled to a certain type of tag for my car. And that's about what it's good for, right? You know, so here's a case where DOL has an acceptance policy where they require a TARP cert. We have different acceptance policies. Now, why do we trust all these statements? We trust because they're hard to forge, and we trust the entity that issued them. Whether it's the tags on the back of your car, because it's hard to stamp out license plates, although they seem to be just be printing them these days. They don't seem to be embossing them anymore. You know, registrations are printed on special paper. We trust dollar bills because they're bearer bonds and they're hard to forge for most folks. All those sorts of things, they have physical characteristics in them. In the digital world, we don't have those. We depend upon the cryptography to keep the integrity of the system. We depend upon the digital signatures. If a key gets compromised at a CA, it puts at risk everything that they've signed. Okay? And if your individual key gets compromised, it puts what you've signed at risk. And so everything ultimately depends upon trusting the issuer to have control over their key and trusting them not to lie about the bindings they're making. Okay, this comes back to the VeriSign example issuing the fake Microsoft certs earlier. We trust people who issue certificates to properly attest to bindings. And your confidence in the issuer is what's going to depend, is going to really influence what you're willing to accept in all of these things. Okay, so we go back to our SSL example. right? And, you know, when Alice says, okay, here's what I want to do when I talk, Bob takes his cert and sends it back to Alice along with his key as proof that Bob's key belongs to Bob. In the SSL case, that certificate is going to be some binding between Bob's DNS name and Bob's public key. And Alice looks at it and says, okay, I believe the key that you sent along, and if I trust the issuer, I believe that this binding is true and I'm really talking to you and there isn't someone playing man in the middle. So how do you go get certs? Well, you buy them, right? Or you get someone to give them to. What actually happens when you get a certificate? Bob is running this cert, is running this web server, and he wants to go conduct electronic commerce. What does he do? Well, he goes to a CA, and there's a number of these around the world, that issue certificates, and he goes and asks for a certificate. And the CA issues Bob a cert. And it's really that simple. We'll talk about the protocols that do that a little bit later. Now, I stand up a certificate, I stand up a web server, and I'm going to run SSL on it, and I own my domain name, and I go out and I buy a cert from VeriSign, let's say, and I get that cert back. Is that cert useful? What do I do with it now? Now that I have that cert, what do I do? Well, I send it to people when they ask me to engage in cryptographic protocols as proof that the key that I'm sending them is mine. Well, does Alice believe that the key belongs to me? She does if she believes the cert that I send along with it. Well, what does that reduce to? That reduces to the fact that she's got to believe that the issuer made a proper key name binding. Okay, so the client has to believe that the cert that came down, or the set of certs that comes down, that those are true statements. So how does Alice gain trust in those statements? Have we made the situation any better? Well, I've reduced the problem from Alice trusting Bob's key directly to Alice trusting Bob's CA to make proper issuer keys or subject key statements. Okay, now Bob's CA isn't going to go around and meet everybody, right? So what do we do? Well, I trust Bob's CA if there's someone to vouch for Bob's CA. And I've created an infinite loop, or a regression, a bounded regression. Okay? This has to top out somewhere. And it does, but you can think of the problem in trusting searches. I'm creating search back and forth, and I keep hoping that I'm going to converge at something called a root. One or more implicitly trusted set of keys. So in all of this stuff, as a relying party, you have one or more set of, and I'm going to use the word keys and certs interchangeably for the root here, root cert or root keys, that you implicitly trust. That is anything that, or I guess it's explicitly trust, that you just believe things that come from them, okay? And we'll talk about how you actually build that sort of thing up, but just imagine for the moment that...
Actually, in the case of the user, the user is implicitly trusting. The user is not explicitly trusting because the user has no idea that this is happening.
Well, they installed the software that usually gives it to them. So yes, it is implicit in that case. In an enterprise scenario, often the enterprise will actually explicitly push roots out to the clients. And I'll talk a little bit more about how that works later. But at the end of the day, you have one or more keys, and those keys generally are contained in a self-signed certificate. A certificate where the issuer and the subject are the same, that just attests to the fact that, yeah, hi, I'm the root of this thing. And you trust those explicitly, and we're going to look at how that cascades. Okay? So there's got to be some explicit root of trust in the system, and that's a bootstrapping issue, just like we're bootstrapping anything else. Remember in Kerberos how you had to bootstrap the original relationship between the every user and every server and the KDC in the center? In a PKI, you got to bootstrap the explicit roots of trust. Okay? Now, in 99.99% of the time, that's all done because you've installed either a browser or an operating system that carries this along with you, okay? Or there's some other management that happens, okay?
In some cases, the roots are actually governmental agencies.
They can be. And I should caution that I am talking about the model we're going to talk about in a moment, X509.
But those are not disinterested parties like these idealized
That is correct. In fact, it gets a little bit more complex because based on your environment and what it is that you were relying on certs for, your set of routes may be mandated. I'll give you a very good example. In Germany, they have a very strong digital signature law that says that signatures made with keys that have certificates of a particular form issued by particular CAs have legal effect. That means that those signatures have the force of law like you signed your name. Okay? Utah's got a digital signature law in the U.S. Washington State has, I believe, has one too that's not quite as... Utah's is like you have to be a CA that's present in Utah. Germany's is you got to be certain German CAs that fall under certain guidelines and things. And if you want to fall under, if you want to do electronic commerce under the protections of the German digital signature law, you can only use German digital signature law approved route CAs as trust authorities. And that actually also implies stuff about the certs. I have to look into it. Okay? Other types of governmental agencies have different ones. If you are in the Department of Defense, there are, well, there's like one route maybe for every branch because, you know, the Marines aren't going to let the Army kind of run their PKI. And it kind of gets, and it's even, and we'll actually get to this a little bit later when we talk about what happens to the civilian side of the U.S. government. But you basically have these sorts of things. If I look at Microsoft internally has a PKI, right? There is a route for that PKI that is internally pushed to everybody's machines because they're all part of that. Or that, I'm sure Boeing and the other large, you know, companies that have rolled out PKIs do the exact same sort of thing. For public, in terms of sort of client-server interactions, you know, like for SSL, it tends to come down under the covers through the browser, and we'll talk about that, and I'll show you some examples a little later. Okay? So you've got to trust some set, and then you get this hierarchy of CAs. And that's where the infrastructure part of the situation comes in. Okay? So the difference between the certs or the individual statements, the PKI is the infrastructure that is built around this and how we basically reason about collections of certificates. I'm going to go a little bit further. So what's a CA? Well, it's this entity that gets to charge you $400 or more for making little digital signatures, right? It's an authority that guarantees name key bindings, and it can do those for either another CA or it can do it for what we call end entity. End entity is the generic term for anything at the bottom for which, you know, is a subject for which a cert's issued. But CAs can also certify other CAs, and that's how you build up a tree hierarchy. And an end entity can be a person, it can be a role, it can be a machine, it can be a web server, it can be an account. Not all CAs support that. It's a piece of policy. If I go to Verisign and I say I want to go get a certificate for a pseudonym that I've created that's blogging anonymously, they're not going to give me one necessarily, or they won't give me a high-valued one. They might give me a low-valued one. If I stand a business up and I want a certain type of certificate, I may have to be a bank in order to get a certain class certificate from a certain group of individuals, things like that. And again, this all comes down to, you know, what sort of name key bindings are the CAs willing to attest to and willing to validate. And so we get these very nice colorful tree diagrams where if I'm running SSL, I have one or more of these root CAs that I trust, and the goal here is that this CA is going to certify this CA, and this CA certifies this CA and this end entity, and he certifies this guy, and you build up a natural tree relationship in the simplest case. Okay, it gets a lot more complicated than this, but in the simplest case, you can think about CAs being related to each other based off this deduction tree. Now, I have this thing that I call a no-frills cert, which is basically just two boxes linked together. There's tons of information in certificates. The average cert's probably 1 to 2K in size, and as I'll show you later on, can have 15 to 20 different extensions in it, not all of which make sense together. Okay, so you got to kind of interpret them funny. But at the top level for the next set of diagrams, let's just think about certs having an issuer and a subject. Okay? And again, the subject really is a key and a name that are bound together. And this issuer you can think about as just an issuer name. Okay? And that's sort of the core element of what we're dealing with in a cert at the 30,000 foot level. So when we ask if Alice trusts Bob's key, and so this is Bob, and this is Alice's root. You know, Alice's restaurant, Alice's root. Woody Guthrie, Arlie Guthrie, whatever. You know, okay. I'm too old for you guys, I guess. Okay. So this subject here would be Bob, and the first CA that Bob, this is Bob's CA, And then Bob CA gets certified by the Root CA, and then we get a chain of certificates. And so Alice trusts Bob's key if she can cryptographically verify each of these and link them together. Notice that she's got to actually verify two signatures, plus she's got to trust this key implicitly, and she's got to believe that these guys are linked together. Okay? Seems like kind of an easy sort of thing. And that's all we're doing. Given an end entity cert, is there this cryptographically valid chain of certs of signatures that lead you from one to the other? Let's go through the next one. In theory, chaining should be real simple, right? I mean, it's RSA validations or DSA validations. It's just doing signature checks, and we're just, you know, I have a chain of certs or I have a pile of certs and I construct the chain, I just gotta go check them, right? Real simple. Well, it's actually a lot more complicated than that from the policy perspective. So first thing that can happen is you can get kind of complicated trees. Okay? Not a real big sort of deal, but, you know, here I am and I could be trying to search for different people and I can get different paths through the hierarchy. A real simple hierarchy. Right? Not a big deal. You see what's going on? Let me sort of erase this here. And imagine that I've got, you know, a CA here, a root CA, VeriSign or what have you, or my enterprise root, and I've set up, let's say it's an enterprise root, and I've set up a CA for the East Coast and the West Coast, and those CAs certify employees. Now, if I happen to, you know, I trust this root, and I have an employee come up to me here and say, I want to prove to you that I am an employee in this company, that employee sends me his cert. That in and of itself is not enough information to convince me, because I also have to need this one. Maybe he sends me the entire chain of both of these, or maybe I go out and I go find this one. Okay? Maybe it turns out I don't actually like that CA for some reason, because he's misbehaved. And I say, can you send me a different chain? And he can't prove. Because my acceptance policy is somewhat different. But in the general,
When you get a certificate from, say, like VeriSign or something like that, can you get them to send you some sort of certificate specifically for the purposes of operating your own CAs in your organization?
Yes.
Is that different from the ordinary certificate that you...
Yes, it is. It's very different for a couple reasons. One, they charge you a lot more money for it.
Okay.
Two, let's drill.
Registration authority, right?
No, actually, that's a slightly different sort of thing. Okay, let's draw that out for a second and talk about it. Okay, because it's a good example. So let's say that this is VeriSign. Okay, and let's say that this is also a VeriSign CA, and this is me, and I go and I get a Class 1 cert, which is something for email. Okay, and this and what you're looking at on the left side of that dotted line is all stuff VeriSign runs. Then let's say that I run a business and I decide that I want to be able to issue my employees a whole bunch of certs so they can communicate with the people at large. Because what's on the left side here is public. It's part of the public infrastructure, assuming everyone trusts VeriSign. So I come along and, you know, here I am, foo.com, and I come to VeriSign and I say, I want to subordinate myself into your hierarchy. I want to plug in and I want you to sign me in so that I can issue my own certs to my employees. What's the risk to VeriSign at that point? VeriSign's taking on liability when they do that. Right? There is a contractual relationship that has to happen there because they are letting you, a third party, run a piece of their hierarchy.
Yeah.
A, they're going to charge you a lot for it because they're losing all the revenue for every cert that you issue to your employees. I mean, you're buying in bulk in some sense. And you're taking on some of the cost. They're also going to restrict who you can issue certs for. Because there's a danger here that you as foo.com, could come in and lie.
To a spam or something.
Well, yeah. All of a sudden you say that it's BillG@Microsoft.com, right? And then, you know, there's a $15 million credit line on it or something, right? You can put those out, right? So there's limits. And in fact, we'll talk later in constraints on how a CA at the root like VeriSign can put constraints in this point to limit what they can issue, okay?
So, but an alternative then, if you're running a business and you're on a budget, would be to have your own root CAs, but they're only trusted within your organization.
That's right. That's absolutely the case. Look, PKI is basically, I mean, you can run your own internal PKI basically for free these days. Okay. Yes, you can go buy stuff, but you know, if you're on Windows, you can go. It comes along with the server product. You can go run it on any of the free, you know, Linux and BSDs, and you can go issue your own certs, and you can go hand them out to people. And the key thing is, I can give certs to all my own employees, and within my enterprise, as long as they all trust my enterprise root, that's great. But what happens when you do that for company A and you do that for company B, and you guys don't trust each other, right? Now, you can either choose to trust each other directly, and we'll talk about that in a moment, after the break, or what's the benefit of going and subordinating to a public CA? Again, this is a business model question, okay? You guys kind of get the difference? I mean, that's what matters. All right, I'll tell you what, it's 35. Let's take a five-minute break. We'll come back at 41, 7:41, and we'll continue on with more complex chain building. Okay, 5 minutes. All right, so the picture on this slide is sort of the easiest of the chain building examples. I've got a tree structure, and you all remember from algorithms, you know, trees are easy to deal with and that sort of thing. It can easily get more complicated where I can start to have multiple paths to multiple routes, and the paths may have different qualities and mean different things. So here's an example of that. Let's say that I'm a user here, down here, good old EE3, and I go and I get a cert from VeriSign, and I get a cert from my enterprise. And my enterprise maybe then cross-certifies with VeriSign. There could be three different cert paths that I can present to someone on the other end of a connection. So let's imagine that I am trying to send you a piece of signed email, and I want to include a cert chain along with that email to convince you that the key belongs to me. Which chain do I send? How do I know which one to send? Yep.
Can a certificate be issued by two authorities? What's a one-to-one mapping?
A cert's issued by one authority, but so, and this that's actually a good point. So, you know, it's got one issuer and a subject, but the so let me erase this for a second and kind of clear this up here. Okay, so this is a this is a user. That's me. This is a CA. Here's the cert. So this is the cert issued by CA2 to EE3. Here's another cert issued to me into the same key and name binding, but issued by CA1 over here, different CA. Right? So I've got, you know, here's, let's look at the certs for a second. And in fact, this is a really good point because sometimes when we think about cert chains, we forget about the fact that there's entities in the middle of those. So if you focus here on certs A and certs B, that's a chain from this root CA2 to CA2 to EE3. Okay? Two certs. If I look at A prime B, that's the path up this way. Root CA1, CA2, EE3. If I go, well, I guess this is B prime A double prime, that's a completely different path. Right? Where I may pass through some of the same CAs or different CAs. So I could have, for example, I could give you the AB chain, or I could give you the A prime B chain, or I could give you the A double prime B prime chain. And each of those chains may have different properties associated with them. Okay? Question in the back.
Why would you not send all of them?
A couple reasons I wouldn't want to send all of them. One is space, okay, bandwidth. Two is I may not want to reveal to you the fact that I have certificates from other authorities. Give you the real common case, right? CA1, here's VeriSign, public CA, and I've gotten a public S/MIME cert for it. I also happen to have an S/MIME cert that says I have the rights to communicate securely within some group in Microsoft. I don't want to send that out on the public wire. Okay. Now, if you delve into SSL, there's actually, as part of the handshake, there's the ability for each side to sort of state what routes it's willing to accept. Okay, and so part of the negotiation is, hi, I'm the server, and hi, I'm the client, and the server kind of, and they can say what routes they are willing to accept. You can try to guess and put information together. It's always a guess, because if I say that I'm willing to accept VeriSign CA15 as a root CA, you construct a chain to that, you don't really know what my total overall acceptance policy is, right? You might give me a chain that chains up to that, but some of the other things inside the search don't work for me. Or dynamically, we do a lookup, and it turns out one of the intermediate certs has been knocked out because the machine's been compromised or something. So it's always a guess. In a mail case, it's even harder because you don't know a lot about the other party, right? And if you're, but that's kind of why when you sign with a particular key, a lot of the user interface in signed mail tends to focus on the certificate associated with it, and they'll build a chain back. And I'll be honest, this is allowed in the architecture, but a lot of the software out there really deals in the simple hierarchy. You know, one of the first developers I worked with at Microsoft believed that this was completely screwy and you should only ever have one parent on any certificate. Okay? And that if you had two, it was an error somehow and someone had screwed up. But the standard actually allows that, and there's times when you want that kind of flexibility. In fact, one of your homework problems, as soon as I put them up on the web when I get home, is going to be about exactly doing that sort of thing when you have rollover. Because let's say that you issue a cert for a year and you have to roll one of these things. You want to have multiple certs valid, multiple paths valid at the same time. Anyway, does that answer your question? Why you want to use it? So, you know, it's sort of keeping things close to the vest in one hand, and also, you know, it's a lot of space. And if I'm trying to do, you know, short sorts of things, then size of the certs is going to dominate the rest of the information I'm sending. Right? Again, and also, the amount of work I have to do to verify these things. And if I send you five chains, then maybe there's some way you don't know what certs are on the other end and how they could put that together. And it could even be even more. You know, there could be more paths through the graph. Because you really are talking about some directed acyclic graph here. Actually, it could be cyclic. It's a directed graph, and you're going to follow it and try and build a chain up to whatever the one of those trust groups are. Now, you still have another question. You got answered? Good. Other questions at this point? Okay, so let's move on and talk about what happens when you start with two independent hierarchies. So let's take, a military example, where I have the Army and the Navy, and, you know, they don't even like to share sides of a football stadium, okay? Now imagine what happens when you have an Army PKI and a Navy PKI, and they're told that they want every person in the Army to be able to send signed email to the Navy and vice versa. They should trust it. And the guys in the Army don't want to trust the Navy CA, and the guys in the Navy don't want to trust the Army CA. Okay? This happens a lot. In fact, the motivator behind this was the fact that, like, every department inside the U.S. government started putting up their own CAs, their own root CAs. And no cabinet-level department is going to subordinate to any other cabinet-level department. Okay? And in the military, even though you have a strict hierarchy in the military, the fact is every branch is kind of on its own. And you get this even in corporations. So the concept of something called a bridge CA was created, which was an intermediate node that was sort of owned jointly by a collective and would do what was called cross-certification. So imagine that you stand a neutral CA up in the center, and the bridge CA certifies the root CA, and the root CA certifies the bridge CA to create a two-way link. And the bridge CA does that on the other side. Okay? So now you've got the ability to do paths from one to the other. So if this user over here in the Navy sends mail to someone in the Army, they can give a path that's got a, there's a cert here, and then it would go through that cert, and then it would go through that cert. Okay? And you would get a chain of four certificates ultimately chaining in that root CA. If it got sent to somebody else inside of the Navy on the right-hand side, only these two certs would be needed because the other person would trust that root. Okay? See how that works? These things can get really kind of complex, and you end up with a graph-solving problem, and you actually apply sort of all of the techniques that we have in general graph theory to solving those sorts of problems.
So in this example, in the end, everyone in the Navy trusts everyone in the Army, right?
No, they all trust the bridge CA.
They trust the bridge. They trust everyone in the Navy trusts the Navy route, and they are willing to trust the fact that the Navy route certified the bridge CA in that cert to do something, and the bridge CA certified the Army route as a subordinate. So here's the thing, and I've kind of made, let me go on to one more diagram so it's a little bit cleaner. In this case, this guy is a route, but this is an Army route, okay? And this is a Navy route. If I'm in the Navy, that's not a route to me. It's just an intermediate CA. Whereas, if I'm in the Army, that's not a route to me. That's just an intermediate CA. And this is another intermediate CA. That bridge is there. And the only route I trust is this one. So you have an asymmetric view of the world, right? You have two parties communicating that have different trust sets, but because there's enough sort of certificates and mutual agreements, each side is able to convince the other because they've got some cross relationships in place. Question?
Yeah. Why does the bridge CA have to be there at all? Why can't the Army and Navy routes just certify each other and each treat the other as a subordinate CA?
Okay, so they could do that directly. However, as you get, and if you only had two, you could certainly do that and they could cross-certify directly. Now, what happens when you have 20 cabinet-level departments? Right? In fact, this was a problem set question from 4 years ago, so now we can't use it now. If you have 20 departments cross-certifying, you do like 20 times 19 over 2, right? Or actually, no, you'd have to certify everybody else. You'd need 380 cross-certs, right? If you had a large conglomeration of people that all wanted to have this property, you do the bridge CA so that you get linear growth as opposed to quadratic growth, okay? If you have a small number, you certainly could do that. It gets more interesting if you think about what happens, in a similar sense, down the pipe. So let's say that, let me erase this. Let's say that this isn't the Army and the Navy, but let's say that what you've got is Microsoft and Boeing, right? And Microsoft and Boeing don't want to cross-certify their complete hierarchies, but what they'd like to do is a subordinate group inside of Redmond wants to cross-certify with a group in Everett. Okay, and so you've got a piece of Boeing and a piece of Microsoft that want to share, so you might actually get some cross-certification happening at this level in the hierarchy, not at the root level of the hierarchy. That's possible, too. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Great. Okay. So what I had on this diagram is you could also imagine cases where after you've done this cross-certification between the Army and the Navy, this person in the Navy actually goes and gets a cert from the Army directly, and then you get two possible paths to prove to somebody in the Army, which is the Army route, whether or not you either go through the bridge CA or you go directly up in the hierarchy. So you can get more complicated structures. Okay? And that's just at the sort of crypto linking level. We haven't gotten into any of the other sorts of things that happen yet. Okay, so let's talk about how I determine if two certs really link together. Okay? And again, this should be easy, right? It's kind of like, well, they match and the signatures kind of match up. This turns out to have been a religious schism inside of the PKI community, and it has to do with whether you believe in names or keys as principles. Okay? And let me explain a little bit of history about that just to give you a flavor. And at the end of the day, within the X509 world, which is what most people use, it's all about names. If you go to the PGP world, which I'm not really going to talk about tonight, but I just want you to understand, it's more about keys. Okay? But most of what people do, it's all based on names at the end of the day. So I got to introduce some abbreviations first, just so that when you run into these things in the real world, you know about them. There is this thing called X509 version 3, which is the standard, the base standard for certificate formats that are used by SSL and IPsec and WPA and wireless and SMIME and sort of everything else that comes out of the IETF. Now, X509v3 is an ITU standard, which is the International Telecommunications Union. So it was codified in this thing called PKICS, which is the working group in the IETF for PKI. It's the PKI based on X509 working group. That's what the PKI and the X are for. All the data structures that are described for certs are described in this thing called ASN.1 notation. Has anyone seen that before? Okay, a couple of you have. You don't look too happy. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's a real painful sort of experience in dealing with it. And it's sort of, how can I put this nicely? It's a language for describing data structures that was designed for standards committees because it makes it exceedingly easy to put choices in. And so in a standards body, when you get two people fighting over the way they're going to do something, the easiest way to say is, oh, well, we'll just make both possible and it's an optional and you choose on your own. And ASM.1 is really good at doing that. But it's this abstract notation that defines things like sequences and sets and tags and a whole bunch of data structures. And you write this out, this abstract notation, and then you specify an encoding rule, a way in which to take the abstract notation and boil it down to a sequence of bytes. One way to do that is called DER, Distinguished Encoding Rules. DER is a packed binary representation. When I taught this 4 years ago, I walked the class through a whole bunch of DER notation. People didn't like that too much, so I decided to spare you all that this time. We're just going to go look at things abstractly, but I want you to know that when you get out in the real world, DER is the thing that converts an abstract notation. It actually tells you how to go create a packed binary representation. That's what gets signed in these certs. So certs are DER-encoded ASM.1. I just want you to know that if you run into it. Is there a question?
I see PEM a lot more than DER.
Okay, so PEM, Privacy Enhanced Mail, was a very old format for moving keys around that basically is only still used because OpenSSL lets you kind of do stuff with it on its own. It's an old ASCIIfication of a binary format that gets used a lot, and that was based on a very early pre-ESPine standard, but still gets used. And in fact, when I go, you know, have to create a cert for, you know, the SSL for my server under Apache, I end up using PEM format. Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess maybe it depends on what camp you're on—the Windows side or the
no. If you are talking out to say to a VeriSign or something, the X509 certificate that you get is going to be a DER encoded certificate because that's what the standard is. PEM is a way of then taking that binary blob and turning it into ASCII text so it's mail safe,
okay.
Kind of like Base64 or UU encode. It's all those sorts. It's one of those. That's what PEM is. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I guess maybe it's because you need to sometimes submit it as a, say, into a web form or something.
Absolutely.
Like that. So you need some type of ASCII.
Yeah, so DER doesn't give you that because it's binary. Now, of course, the ANSI guys would, or the ASM.1 guys would tell you that you ought to use a text-friendly encoding rule. Okay? Now, you can't do that for a cert, but they actually have things like ZER, which are the XML encoding rules, that take an abstract data structure and then convert it into the abstract XML data structure if you want to do that. And then they have something called basic encoding rules. And BER can be used for S/MIME, but you don't use it for certs because there's not a unique representation. And when you are taking a certificate and encoding it, you got to know there's exactly one way to write it. Okay, and that's what DER gives you. That's why it's distinguished. There's only one way to take a data structure and encode it. And basically what DER is, it's all length prefixed stuff. Okay. Now, X509 they have to know this. It's important history, okay? X509 came from something called the X500 directory model, which was, how can I put this nicely? Sort of an attempt by the ITU to create a global directory in which everybody would have one place in the world, a single rooted hierarchy for the world. Okay, that's basically the way to think about it. And the only remnant of an X500 was a huge, it was part of a whole OSI stack, which you probably learned about in ancient history and networking classes and things like that. The only part of that that exists today in any remnant form is X509, and it has cursed us and will for, you know, decades to come. It is based on this directory model. So a lot of the things that happen in the cert model are inherited from the notion that it started with the presence of a global directory that had a unique way of naming everyone in the universe. That's not true. I mean, that's not a presumption anymore, but that's why some of the data structure exists. So if you ask, well, why are they using these hierarchical names that seem so weird? It's because you have to keep in the back of your mind that this all came from a time at which the goal was to associate one certificate with every node in the global directory for every person in the world. Okay? That just kind of lays it out there. So, you know, I have this little, this, you know, one directory to rule them all, one directory to define them, you know, comes off of the Lord of the Rings sort of thing. But that was the goal of X500. And when you got to the distinguished model, what happened in the X500 world was, you had a node that defined a country, and then you had states or provinces, and then you had localities, and then you had organizations, and then you could have organizational units, and then you could have common name equals underneath it to get even deeper. And there was this logical hierarchy of qualifiers, C for country, SP for state or province, Oregon, Washington, California, L for locality, O for organizations, and you built up this hierarchy of names. And there was a particular way of encoding the names, and you could look at this ASCII structure that was the structured name, and it told you where in the global directory this person was. And that has stayed with us. And all of the names that we talk about when we talk about certs are names of this structured form. The structure hasn't survived. The global directory hasn't survived, but the structure has survived. So in practice, when you go to VeriSign or anyone and get a cert, they're going to give you a name that has some of these weird components filled out that are inherited from the X500 directory. So you're going to say, if you were deploying one of these, for example, and you have to map certificates to accounts on your system, the mapping software is going to ask you how you want to map on organizational unit basis, or on country basis, or on these collections. And you're going to say, well, why the hell is this all important? Well, it's because it came out of this X500 world. Now, luckily, cooler heads prevailed, and they added E for email addresses, which is what most people use for the sort of SMIME. And there's actually alternate fields inside of certs where you can stick other types of identifiers if you need to do so. But when it comes to name matching, and when it comes to the distinguished names that are for issuer and subject, they're all these structured sort of sequences. And so know that for when you come across it. Now, if you own your CA, you get to define what goes in your distinguished names. You can completely control it. You can say, you know something? I don't really care about anything except for whatever your legal name is. Or all I'm going to put in it is, you know, your employee ID number or something else like that. When the U.S. military actually defines what their distinguished names look like, they define a bunch of things that have meaning within their environment. Okay? It gets really strange if you try to force fit it into common software. So one of the things that happens, let's say, you take the example of you're running OpenSSL, and you're creating a cert to go put into your Apache web server. And when you run the create command inside of OpenSSL, it asks you for what your organizational unit is. And you're like, well, I don't know what my organizational unit is. So you make something up and put it in. Or you use the default, which is don't trust this organizational unit or something like that. Okay? But that's why a lot of these things show up, because they come out of, you know, snake oil, right? Isn't it snake oil?
Snake oil.
Yeah. Snakeoil.com, right? Or snake oil software. These are what come in because the defaults require a certain amount of structure, and as we'll see in a moment, this is what the basis of chaining is all built on, is on matching these sort of name structures. Okay. So here you have the X509 standard, which is a subordinate of the X500 global directory. Remember, every person in the world has a node in the directory. How is the subject of a cert identified? By its distinguished name for its place in the global directory. How is an issuer identified? By its distinguished name for its place in the global directory. How are certs linked together? By matching names. This all comes down to doing name matching on the global directory. So, when you look at the key fields inside of a cert, there are three on top of everything else. The three key fields. The subject's public key, the subject's distinguished name, and the issuer's distinguished name. And that's what's there. What's missing? What's not here? Anyone?
DNS?
Well, that would be a type of one, but...
The issuer's public key? The signature?
The issuer's public key is not present in the cert. You cannot verify the integrity of a certificate without finding its parent. Because you don't know the public key of the issuer. You only have the signature on it. So a very important point. If you just send me your end entity cert, it is useless to me in some sense. Because what I get is I get the issuer's name, I get your subject name, and I get your public key, and I get a signature that was made with the issuer, but I don't have the issuer's public key in and of itself. I have to find that some other way. Either a question here. Why?
There's no point in sending it, because if you send it, how can you trust it? Like, so you verified it, but...
Well, so there's two steps. There's two steps. Remember, in all of this, is the signature cryptographically valid, and then do I trust the key? Okay, I can't cryptographically validate the cert until I go find its parent. which I don't trust yet, extract the key from it, go back and verify the cert, and now that I've cryptographically verified the cert, now I can decide whether I trust its parent, and I recurse. And in fact, which I get to in a bit, you end up having to build up and build down, too, and you end up walking the chain both ways.
Is it like savings in space because the key takes up so much space?
Well, so the reason, again, this comes back to a little religion thing. If names are the most important things in the world, all I care about is sending the names along, and finding the key is just a lookup into the global directory. Because, of course, that's what you do, right? You just go query the global directory using DAP. Okay.
But what is the global directory?
Well,
where's the global directory server?
Well, you would know. Okay. But that was the point. That was the model. And so that's one thing that's carried over. And so, as you'll see, we have now come up with all these extensions to help you go find the right issuer public key and to locate certs in case you don't get them. Now, in practice, what happens is you tend to send the chain down. So when you create an SMI mail message, you put in basically a chain up to but not including the root. Okay? When you do an SSL TLS transaction, you end up sending the chain across. Now the other guy still has to trust that, and if any of those intermediate certs break, he's basically back to square one and trying to build a chain again. But we tend to include chains, one chain, in our common transactions.
Or if your bundle has, say, some of the pieces of the chain, you only send the part of the chain that's not in the bundle, right?
You could do that, although in practice it's never done. Basically, in practice, if you're going to send it, you send a chain that you believe is going to convince the guy at the other end. Either you've got a private label protocol where you kind of know that the certs are distributed out of band, or you end up sending a chain across. And that's what happens.
Getting some certificates where... They were signed by certs, but at least most of the certs were in the root bundle, and the ones that you cared about were the...
Well, that can be where certain intermediates are known to exist.
I guess what I'm saying is the root bundle also contains intermediate
non-root. No, right? Well,
kind of?
Not really. If it's a root bundle, those are things that you explicitly trust, and the chain builder will stop when you hit them.
Okay. But some of the certs in there are actually signed by other certs in there sometimes?
They're not if they're real trusted roots.
Well, you can trust whatever you want to trust, though, right?
You could, but they're not... You're kind of perverting the model at that point. Okay. All
right.
It's done in some cases, but it's perverting the model. Okay. So let's get back to this notion of I'm a relying party. Someone has given me a set of an end entity cert, and I want to verify it. My task is to go construct a chain, one or more chains, up to one of my trusted roots, and I'm starting with this end entity cert. And what do? Well, I got to go look around for possible parent certs. Okay. So what's a valid parent cert? Well, in the raw model, it's a cert whose subject name matches the issuer name in the cert I'm trying to validate. Okay. Now, there's this assumption you got a directory handy that you can go query, which, again, doesn't really exist in practice. But, you know, for the moment, assume that you had a directory and you can go kind of search the world to find certs. If you don't have a directory, you got to go do the matching. Now, name matching, you'd say, well, look, all I've shown you is some components of a name, and that's pretty easy, right? I just, you know, sort of compare strings, right? How do I actually match names? Okay, how do we match names in the real world, right? We do some sort of string compare. How do I match two DNs? The official X509 rule, which comes out of the X500, is you use what's called the directory name matching rules, which meant that you took the name object and you put it into the directory and you got something back. And you took the other one, you put it in, you got something back. And if you got the same things back, then you knew that you were looking at the same thing. You basically query the directory twice to see if you got the same object back. That works if you got a DAP directory around. Doesn't work otherwise. So then folks said, well, we'll be mildly smart about it. We'll remove our spaces, we'll do case folding, we'll do stuff like that. And that was a complete disaster in trying to do name matching. Because you get things like, you know, the fact that the Turkish I happens to have, you know, there's an uppercase dotted I and an uppercase non-dotted I, and they don't lowercase the same way. And, you know, you get sorts of things that get really confusing. And so then they decided that, okay, we're not going to be smart about name matching. We're going to be really dumb. And we're just going to do binary comparisons, straight binary comparisons, which is okay, you know, just exact match, but it kind of blows the problem the other way. Are those equal? Yes or no?
This is why we're in the same coding.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So the answer is maybe. Two Unicode characters. Why? Because in Unicode, that could be one character, E with an accent. Not even counting encoding tables, right? It could be an E accent. It could be an E followed by a non-spacing accent. It could be a non-spacing accent followed by an E. You have different ways, right, with glyphs of actually encoding the same visual representation. If you do exact binary matching and it turns out that this is, you know, an E and this is the E plus the accent non-spacing, binary comparison will say that those things don't match. And you will never be able to debug that because you'll look at them graphically and they'll look like the same gosh darn character that they are, right? And you'll see it visually. So there's a lot of, you know, there's unfortunately, when you're trying to do text comparisons in some smart way, you end up getting screwed one way or the other. There was a real big problem in PKIX in that the binary encodings that were originally supported in the certs didn't support international characters. Okay? So we didn't have Unicode support. We had support for, well, we had support for quad byte Unicode, which was really heavyweight. We had support for ASCII. We had support for this thing called T61, which was some teletype font that you had to support but no one ever used. And then they finally added UTF-8 string, which is sort of, you know, the standard encoding for that, where you take Unicode and you get, you know, variable byte length encoding depending. And for ASCII, it happens to compress to the same thing. And now that's all we do. We just do straight binary comparison on names. So you got to kind of wonder what we saved in going through all of this. And that as we do name chaining, all we're doing is binary blob comparisons of names at the end of the day, but that's because of where we started with. Okay, so moral?
You can just as easily do binary blob comparisons of keys.
Absolutely. And some of us argued for that in the IETF and got disinvited from the IETF for PKIX. The fact is they were stuck on this sort of thing. If you look at the PGP model is all built off of keys. And you could actually, if you went to this cert model but did key-based chaining as opposed to name-based chaining, you'd actually get a lot more flexibility. Because guess what? People's names do change over time. If you have two companies that merge, you actually have to rename everybody that you've certified and reissue the certs.
Or even if you move your base to some different city or something else.
Well, that's why nobody bothers to put cities and stuff in their certs basically anymore, because you'd have to break the names and stuff. But under the original model, you never moved. You kind of got this one name I associated with you for life based on, like, where you were born or something. Okay? And so your place in the global directory never changed. Okay?
Even if you were flying a spaceship somewhere or something.
Even if you changed citizenship or what have you, right? Mm-hmm. But all of those sorts of problems. There's a guy named Peter Gutman who, like, has this wonderful paper on trashing, all of this sort of stuff, where he talked about people, like, living on mobile oil platforms who had no country. And, you know, couldn't exist in the global directory because they were outside the bounds of what was nameable in the global directory and things like that. And that those sorts of problems happen, but they don't kind of count. Now, name matching is the beginning of the process but not the end of the process. Just because two certs name change doesn't mean that you have a proper chaining relationship. You now have a possible chaining relationship. But whether or not the certs chain actually depends upon a whole bunch of other information that's in the certs and potentially your own acceptance policy. You could have a policy, for example, that says, you know, depending on what the time is, some of those certs may no longer be time valid, and so you throw them out. You also could have a policy based on other sorts of things that are in the certs. So this whole chain building process is really influenced by the information you find inside of the certs. You're probably staring at this and saying, because we're going to go into what some of these things are, why would anybody ever want to write this chain building code, and why would I ever want to go look at this myself? And so the answer is you don't, and you go use one of the common libraries that does this, because you never want to touch this problem yourself, you just want to use it. And in most of the sorts of things that you're going to be asked to do, the problems that are going to come up are you're going to be asked how to map certificates to accounts. You're going to be asked about what information to go in, goes into search, and you have a lot of flexibility on that based on your environment. But how things chain, you ought to know what goes into these, and the reason we're going to cover this, because the way you kind of set the PKI up can control how things roll. Right? The best advice I can give you on all of this is to, you know, if you're rolling out a big PKI, testbed everything first. Testbed what happens when somebody leaves your company and you have to revoke their certificate. Testbed what happens when somebody gets married and they come back and tell you they need a name change immediately. Okay. Test all of those sorts of things, because those are all things that impact your PKI. And it's not cool to say, oh, you can't have a cert that actually shows your married name until we roll certs in 9 months. That doesn't fly, okay, even if that's the answer. Okay, these sorts of things, and we've learned a lot of these lessons the hard way.
Boeing all the time.
What? You learn lessons the hard way at Boeing?
Well, that too, but yeah. If somebody gets married and nothing gets updated for 9 months.
So that doesn't, you know, at Microsoft, you know, that's how you change your email address.
It's two totally different.
Two totally different cultures, right?
Yeah,
right.
Your
email address won't change, right? I mean, you get the option.
My previous program, there was a woman who the IT department suggested maybe she wanted to keep her maiden name. It was easier.
Okay, so that's not a user, I'm sorry, that's not a user-friendly PKI, okay?
User-friendly IT
organization. Yeah, IT organization, okay?
It's kind of like the, never mind. The communists kind of like get in line kind of.
It is. I will say, and again, this comes from personal experience in deploying these things, that you don't think through a lot of these scenarios that are going to be important, because you got to think through what happens like when time expires and all of a sudden your intermediate certs are no longer valid. Because if you don't think through those things ahead of time, all of a sudden you can get nasty customers calling you up and saying that they can't install software anymore because some certs expired in the middle of the chain. And all of a sudden all the signatures break. Okay, and they'll validate. So this is a real world problem. Okay. And they'll bite you. I had a group at Microsoft that was distributing some software, and they didn't understand the concept of timestamping and the importance of that, and so they had included a component and they shipped it, and then the clock rolled over and their certs expired, and they didn't understand why stuff wouldn't install anymore, and it shut down online. So, you know, this can have real consequences. And when you're looking at business processes where we're automating things and we're sending SMI messages back and forth, this can have real serious consequences, okay, in this sort of thing, and like not getting the information, that sort of thing. Question over here.
In the project I was just on, we shipped a prototype that was using a single cert to sign everything, you know, for all the different identities in the system,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty lame, but anyway.
Yeah.
it's not totally fielded, but it's kind of being tested by the Army and others, and they put a one-year mark in that prototype, you know. They just renewed the cert for the year.
And it expired the day before your presentation with the three-star general who was going to look
something
at it, right?
Like yeah. Something like that.
Yeah, that's why you test these things, you roll stuff forward. Let's talk a little bit about trusted routes. Who do I trust to be at the top of my chains? Well, the answer is anyone I want to trust. Okay. In practice, you get routes two ways. They are slipped in under the covers as part of the software you install. Okay. Or your enterprise tends to push them out to you through some enterprise policy thing. This is a picture of my trusted route store off of my machine as of earlier this morning. I happen to have 110 certificates in that store, I think one of which I actually put there myself, maybe two, one I created and one that came from someone I was communicating with. The rest of them came automatically as part of the system. Now, let me give you a little bit of history as to sort of how this came about. Rewind back to the browser wars, okay? And so you're talking about sort of, you know, Netscape and Microsoft IE kind of trying to, you know, gain dominance. And that's where SSL first really gained prominence. That was the first real application, the real practical application that impacted a lot of people from a PKI perspective. And the solution to root distribution was to bake root certs into the browser. Okay? So Netscape baked a set of root certs into Netscape. And that was how you got roots. And IE did the same thing. Netscape charged $250,000 per year per cert that was baked into the browser. It was a money-making opportunity for them. IE was playing catch-up, and so we didn't charge. And when I joined Microsoft, I was the program manager who one of my duties was to control the root certs in the browser. And I will tell you that on more than one occasion, I had certain organizations offer me $250,000 to get their root cert into the browser because they really wanted to be there, because they wanted the distribution. And as far as I could tell, these were legitimate organizations. They were just kind of small banks or overseas banks or things like that. And we basically had a non-discriminatory policy on what we took in. You had to meet certain requirements. But that distribution was critically important. And it was a real sort of catching game. And VeriSign, which held the patent, or I should know, VeriSign, which was spun off from RSA Data Security Incorporated, and VeriSign was given an exclusive license to do RSA certs in the U.S., and so they have sort of had first mover advantage on that. And then later you had other folks who were issuing certs. But they were the company in the U.S., and so you started with sort of their certs. And then you had other groups come up outside of the United States who were issuing certs, and it was all a matter of who was in the browser. Nowadays, these get shipped either as part of the operating system or as part of, you know, or your browser's the common way that the root certs come along, or as part of enterprise policy. So in a corporation or in the Army or the U.S. government, they're going to push root certs out, and it will be automatically downloaded to the machines in your enterprise. There are some folks where, you know, you can send roots on, you know, as part of your smart card install, you know, insertion or something like that. And in fact, the way Microsoft does it now, actually we only push down, we only install a couple of certs, and then we install a secure download procedure so we can update more root certs automatically. Because there's this maintenance problem. Well, so what happens if somebody comes along and it turns out that, you know, the Germans pass a new digital signature law and have to push new root certs down? We have to have some way of automatically servicing. And so that gets done sort of in the same way that Windows updates services Windows platforms. But this whole notion of baking stuff into the browser, that's where the roots of trust are. And you can look at them, right? And, you know, in some of them, you know, you see that, like, you know, VeriSign's got a whole pile here, and here's CertiSign, Autoridade, Certificadore. And
expired already too.
That Microsoft 99. Some of them, yeah. Here's a timestamp that expired in 99. You'll notice that a lot of these are good out to 2010 or 2020. We originally had only had a 5-year lifespan because we figured the OS would kind of be out of service in 5 years. And so, you know, it was originally we wanted out to 2004, and then we started asking for them out to 2020. Now understand that when someone puts out a cert that's good out to 2028, there's a huge amount of risk they're taking underneath that. And undoing a bad root cert's a real problem, right? And when one of these companies goes under, and that key that is back behind that certificate, which is in some piece of hardware, you gotta know where those things are. Because you don't want them kind of floating around willy-nilly. Okay?
Yeah.
And a lot of these use MD5.
And a lot of the old certs use MD5. And there's a big problem with that. And so part of one of the things we're trying to get the cert authorities off of is off of MD5. And we'd like to get them off of SHA-1, too, for good, but we can get them off of MD5, because, you know, that's now vulnerable.
Is this list for Windows the same in all countries? If I go to Germany, would this list be different?
That's a good question. I believe the answer to that is yes, from an international commerce perspective. It's possible that something's seeded locally. I'd have to go ask the guys currently, because now with this online program, they presumably do have the ability to at least sense and add some things in. But as far as I know, in the past, it's always been sort of one common set. So that's why, you know, you'll get, you know, German ones or, you know, Bolivian ones or things like that on your own, because you might be doing commerce with those folks, and we can't predetermine. What they do now with a lot of this online stuff is that as you walk a chain, if you hit a route that you actually don't know, we have the option of basically going online at that point and querying back to the server to see if it's a new route that you hadn't gotten yet and basically patching it on the fly. And so there's a lot of stuff that happens under the covers to make this all seamless. And you have to do that within network delay times so that, you know, grandma's purchase from L.L. Bean doesn't time out.
Because
you know?
There are very few countries that are in this list. I mean, India and China don't have any.
I think they get faulted in automatically. They'll push within their borders. But yeah, it kind of depends on what Microsoft does, and I don't know what, you know, other folks do. But what Microsoft does these days is we have this sort of standard, not reasonable, non-discriminatory process for including roots into this program. And it requires that basically a CA prove that, you know, they have certain assets behind them and that they have certain, you know, they meet certain security goals and that sort of thing. And that's really the only way to deal with it, right? You can't sort of pick and choose when it comes to stuff because too much commerce depends on it. And so you basically just set up a program that says, okay, you know, if you can prove to us the following, that you meet the following legal requirements and sign the following, you know, business relationship contracts and agree to whatever, you know, those sorts of things are, then you get included. And yeah, you're right. And it's only going to get worse and stuff. And this is sort of the flaw of the whole thing, right? Because you can imagine every country, of course, wanting their own national governmental CAs for business with the governments. right? And then you add on commerce inside those countries and, you know, cross-border things, and, you know, you may have the Eurozone inside of Europe, but you're still going to have individual CAs because the legal effect is different in the particular country.
If a country can get their CA put into, built into the Microsoft browser, doesn't that leave a huge hole for internet terrorism?
No, I don't really see why. Right? The question is these are the routes that are trusted for issuing bindings. So I guess if a bad one gets in, period, okay, that is willing to lie, then you're right, it could issue false bindings.
You can bootstrap false bindings.
And you can bootstrap false bindings off that.
Or instead of something like, you know, I don't know, just one of the countries, for example, that we don't trust very much right now. Like, you know, that's...
Well, there's the seven we can't export to.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you know, they said we weren't developing nuclear, you know, stuff, you know, until just recently, and then it came out, and then, you know, I'm thinking about that.
I think if...
I've seen it in France, but...
Yeah, I mean...
anyway, I'm just...
Okay, so, you know, that's a conversation we should have offline.
Okay.
Not on camera. But... You know, I think there's some practicalities that happen here too, right? If you had a country that was sponsoring a route and all of a sudden they were kind of putting out false stuff, well, A, they're going to get booted real fast, and B, you know, I mean, I guess it would work once, probably, you know.
So a minute ago you said that getting rid of a bad route was a real problem.
Yeah.
And so here we're saying it's going to happen real fast.
Well, it's a problem. There's ways of dealing with it, but it requires servicing just like it requires servicing the platforms, right? You're talking about something where, and we'll get to that in
okay, we're going to talk about certificate
revocation. We're going to talk about revocation, okay? So hold that thought.
Can you revoke a root cert?
Yes and no, okay? If I revoke a root, then why do I trust the revocation statement? Because the person who was supposed to revoke was the root. Now, the fact of the matter is that if you own, like, the browser or the platform, wherever you are, you can sort of, at your own policy level, independent of the actual internal mechanism, say, yeah, I'm tossing that root out. Okay? So that's kind of what happens. Okay?
So,
but let's walk.
Okay.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so shouldn't Windows Update and get Firefox.com be over SSL?
Windows Update, parts of Windows Update actually are.
I was just playing with it, I couldn't find a lock.
You probably won't see it in the browser, but in the actual underlying stuff, or either that or what it downloads will all be signed. Okay. Firefox certainly should be, okay, for the same reason. Okay. And you're right, I haven't seen that either.
So, I mean, the browser's clearly not part of the formal sort of chain, but in terms of practical effect, it's very definitely a layer of trust that...
Yeah, in fact, originally the certs actually were part of the browser. I mean, it was part of the patent, the crypto package that was part of sort of the browser updates and that sort of thing. And you're right. I can talk about what happens in Windows, right? What happens in Firefox is sort of slightly different because of the way the libraries are laid out. But the browser is the primary user interface to it. But remember, you also have the same underlying technology being used in your mail clients or being used in IPsec. Right, or you know, you're connecting over WPA or something like that in wireless. But yeah, the browser is an important trust point, and that's why when we do things like, I guess it was XP Service Pack 2, when we turned on revocation checking for, you know, all of the SSL connections, that had a huge impact on network performance, because all of a sudden all of these connections that weren't checking revocation anymore were starting to check revocation, and we had some problems with that where our connections to Windows Update would time out. Because we wouldn't be able to download the CRLs from VeriSign fast enough. So you have real engineering problems when you deal with this, okay? And how much data has to move around. I'll tell you what, before we get into extensions, let's quickly take the break, since we're at a good point, and come back at 35, 8:36, 5 minutes, 8:36. And we'll go through cert extensions and see how far we can get. Time! I was worried I didn't have enough material for tonight. Now I'm running late. So I'm going to speed through the next section a little bit because I want to make sure we get to revocation. So I want to. So the next section, and since this is in the slides, you can kind of look at it a little bit more, was going inside some of the extra things that are in the CA, and I want to just give you a flavor for all the other extension side. So this happens to be a snapshot of my client cert that is inside of Microsoft, snapshot of this morning. You know, it was issued to me on January 4th, 06, and it's good for a year, and it's good for, you know, proving my identity to a remote computer. And this is UI I helped design way back in 98, I guess, and it's still around, so kind of surprised. And I'm not a UI designer, so, you know, don't blame me for it completely. These are all the fields in the cert, and you can see that you have things like a serial number and an issuer and a validity period and a subject and the public key, which it just shows is an RSA, and a whole bunch of extensions, and we'll talk about that a little bit more in detail. And then you get the cert path, and you can see that this cert chains up to an enterprise CA2, to an intranet CA, to a corporate intranet root, and so there's a four-level deep cert hierarchy, right? That this is a root, and then you've got two CAs, and then my identity cert.
Is that information inside the cert?
No, it actually built the chain. So what happens is, what our software happens to do is, in order to display this, is it will actually see if it has enough information to build the chain. And if it can, what is inside the cert is basically enough of a pointer to get to that guy, and then it recursively built that and said, oh yeah, based on the roots on the that are on my machine and what I know about, I was able to construct this chain. So I know this one's okay. If it wasn't able to do that, you'll get I was unable to build a chain, I don't have enough information yet. Okay? But again, usually, this is all about context.
Yeah, so Brian, do you want to take 10 seconds to tell people how to find this with themselves? Because they'll never find it without a couple of pointers.
Okay, yeah. So if you're on in IE, you go to Tools, Internet Options, Connections tab, I believe.
The content tab.
And there's a search button there. And that'll launch it. Or if you happen to like the MMC snap-in, there is a snap-in for the Microsoft Management Console that's a certificate manager, which is what I use to generate this picture here. This is the MMC snap-in, which is you can run from the command line as certmanager.msc, or you can launch it off of the administrative tools. But there's always this hook through IE, and it's off of the content tab and the options, which like no one ever goes to. True story, we tried to get the button to launch this on Windows XP as part of the users and passwords control panel because it was sort of associated with login. And we had a nice button there, we had hooked it up to the control panel, and then the people who own the shell UI came back and said, oh no, you can't have that button there. This is way too complicated and scary for users, and we can't make it easy for users to stumble into the certificate stuff. We have to bury it under a couple of tabs and a couple of advanced dialogues and things like that, because this is scary, and certs should be hard to find, because we don't want users to get scared by them. True story.
Is the scariest thing just that they're going to go in there and manually revoke all their certs and then wonder why?
No, that they will be presented with a dialogue that they don't understand. That looking at this thing, they don't understand what that is, and they shouldn't see that because they could be scared and frightened by it.
That describes most of XP.
Nothing to see here. Move along. Okay, so if I take apart an X509 cert, what's inside it? It's got a version number to tell me what version. There is a serial number, which is supposed to be a unique number within the space of the issuer identifying the cert. Originally, that was a monotonic counter that was increasing. More frequently, it's become a random number or something else that's a long serial number. The issuer is not allowed to ever issue two certs with the same serial number. They're not supposed to do that. If they do that, the chain, you know, they can chain because you chain off name chaining, and you can sometimes chain off name plus serial number, and so the serial number is supposed to be distinct. And you revoke by revoking serial numbers. Okay, so you should have unique serial numbers. You identify the signing algorithm, and as Josh said, a lot of these are like RSAMD5. The validity period for the cert, all certs have to have a validity period. And they must expire at some point in time. Now that can be, you know, 2039, it can be when the epoch rolls over in Unix time, it can be whatever, but you gotta have an expiration date. In a cert can't be unbounded. Subject distinguished name, subject public key. It can't be. You can make it practically unbounded, but you're not allowed to leave the field blank by the standard. Okay. And then we have this bag of extensions, which started as the standard sort of thing, which was, oh, we'll have one or two extensions in case people want to put some private stuff there. And now that's where a lot of the meat of the cert goes. So certificate extensions have a critical flag that says whether they're critical or not, what type they are, and their value. So the set of extensions is a whole bunch of things, and here's a bunch of extensions. Okay? And we'll talk about these. I'm going to just speed through this because I'm going to talk about all of these in later slides. But I want to talk about the critical flag. Critical flag on an extension protects the issuing CA from assumptions made by the software. The idea is that if you set the critical flag on an extension, you have to process it. And if you don't know how to process the extension, you're not allowed to use the extension. Okay, now, what's that mean exactly? Okay, if the flag is set, you have to process it if they recognize it or reject. If it's not set, the extension can be ignored. What does process recognize mean? No one knows, and there's no common agreement on this. These are actual definitions from X509. Non-critical extension is an advisory field, does not imply usage of the key is restricted to the purpose indicated. Just advisory. PKICs. CAs are required to support constrained extensions, which is, but it doesn't say what support means. Does support mean I simply have to understand them and I have to be able to parse them? Or does support mean my behavior actually means I have to be restricted by them? Okay? S-MIME said you have to be able to correctly handle certain extensions. VeriSign said all persons shall process the extension or else ignore the extension. Okay? So there have been attempts to use these critical extensions to prohibit to delicensing. Novell once issued private label extensions that were critical that had a copyright statement in it. And the theory from Novell was that you were not allowed to parse that state that it was critical, and therefore you had to parse and process the statement, otherwise you couldn't use the cert. But you weren't allowed to process the statement because you'd be infringing copyright if you processed it. Because I don't think that flew, but some people thought that flew. So there are two flavors of extensions. There are these usage informational extensions, kind of qualifying the binding, and then there's constraints extensions on how the thing chains. And there's lots of different types of constraints. Here are some common extensions. The first one, and this is key usage. And the idea here was basically to create a bit field that said, what this was the CA restricting what uses the key that was certified to be put to. So like if you had the digital signature key usage, then that said the key could be used to create digital signatures, but not certs. Key encipherment is used for encrypting session keys, key agreement for Diffie-Hellman, key cert sign and key krill sign were said this key was okay to be used to sign certs and krills. And then there was this thing called non-repudiation.
Being
you. Non-repudiation, which was this key is used to sign things and the signer cannot undo the signature. This became a black hole inside of PKICs. If you ever hear people talk about non-repudiation, my recommendation is to run away quickly. Okay? I like this quote. Non-repudiation is anything which fails to go away when you stop believing in it. Okay? But the fact is that when it comes to talking about legal effects, people try to attach certain behaviors to it. And what they, in other words, if I sign a contract, you know, and that has legal effect, there was this attempt to say that if I digitally signed something with a key that had a non-repudiation bit on a cert associated with that key, then I was committed to that thing that I had signed. Now, the first problem with that is I can have multiple certs on a key. So what happens if I have a key that's got two certs on it, one of which has the non-repudiation bit set and the other one doesn't? Oh, well, that's an error. Right? Can't have that, right? But it certainly could happen. Okay? Non-repudiation really doesn't exist. Anyone who tells you that's kind of lying to you. The fact is, whenever you digitally sign something, there is always some ability to repudiate and back away from it. And how easy or difficult that is really depends upon the legal environment in which you're operating. Okay? Anytime you digitally sign something, you have to have the option of undoing that signature at a later point in time because your key may be compromised, because your key could be copied, it could be stolen, you could lose access to the hardware, all these sorts of things happen. So, which is why we'll talk about revocation in a moment. But you gotta sort of plan on that. And anytime that you assert a binding, that binding may have to be undone at some later point in time. And you just have to plan for that causality.
You're compromising something by doing that, though, right? You're compromising the security of someone's word, basically. They can go back on something that they said earlier. Right?
You can. It all depends upon the legal environment. I'll give you a quick example, and then we'll move on. The U.S. military now issues smart cards that have signature keys on them and certs associated with them to, like, paymasters in the Army, okay? Paymasters are personally liable for the money that they receive, okay? If the money disappears, they might go to jail, okay? It's theft, right? It's not, there's no limited liability, right? So that card, when they take an action with the key on that card, it has complete legal effect, and they are committed just like they would be signing something, okay? There are different levels of this, and it really depends on the legal regime. And the important thing I want you to take away from this is that if you ever get into an environment where they ask, well, what's the legal behind this? It all depends on contract law and what happens in a particular environment. And you can't just put a bit in a cert and restrict the way that key is going to get used, or say, oh, well, I gave you a cert that said you can only do this with it, and that's going to restrict the way the key happens. Right? It limits the liability of the issuer, and the issuer could say, I only certified this for this purpose, and you shouldn't rely on more than that. Okay, that's the key thing. Other extensions. Subject key ID and authority key ID are short hashes, basically, of the keys that are used for doing better lookups as opposed to these name-based lookups in directories. Krill distribution points became real important, and there was actually the subject of a patent fight, in fact, over this particular extension. This is a list of URLs that point to the locations where Krill information, that is revocation information, for this certificate is published. Okay, you can get a patent on stuff like that. Authority info access is a pointer to publishing locations for the parent cert. So if I'm given a cert and I don't know where the parent is, this might give me a hint. So none of these are guaranteed to work, but they're hint locations for where I can go look online to get more information.
Is that a URL too?
Yeah, they're all URI lists, basically. Mostly they're HTTP, you'll see FTP, and some LDAP inside it. But technically, I think any URI can appear. Bless you.
So I ask you a question on email. I get you give me an email back that says yes, and it's got a cert on it, and it's got all this stuff.
That's right. And in fact, if we go back and look at that picture of my cert on it, you'll find it's got all these extensions in it.
Okay.
Plus, it's got a couple, because it was issued by a Microsoft CA. It'll have some Microsoft proprietary ones, like the template it was issued under and the policy on the CA and things like that. Okay. Basic constraints is a real important one. This is a constraint that allows a CA to stick into a cert and say whether this is an intermediate cert or an end-entity cert, and if it's an intermediate cert, what's the maximum depth that that CA that he's certifying is allowed to further issue underneath. So here's the scenario. I've got a CA here, and I'm going to certify another CA, but I want to say he can only issue end-entity certs. I'm going to issue him a basic constraint extension that says, yes, he's a CA, but he can only have like a path length of 1 underneath him, or 0. I forget if it's 0-based or 1-based. Okay? And so you can actually constrain the depth. So back when you asked earlier about subordinating, if I was a company and I was going to subordinate into VeriSign, VeriSign would put one of those extensions in the cert they gave to my local CA. And they would say that I was a CA, but I was only allowed to issue this depth. And then they'd add a name constraint to it and say I was only allowed to issue certs underneath me whose names were of a particular form. And then there's other sorts of policy mapping that this is sort of other random qualifiers that go in, which I'm not going to go into for lack of time. Still more extensions. Key usage wasn't enough, so we came up with extended key usage, which is basically a free-form list of things like SMIME, SSL client auth, SSL server auth, authenticode signing, things like that. Private key usage period was an attempt to say in a cert that the private key could only be used to do private key operations over a particular period of time, independent of when the cert was valid. It's fallen out of favor. And then subject alt name is where you put everything that doesn't fit in distinguished names, like email names, DNS names, X400 names, IP addresses. So often you'll go look at subject alt name for other places where you'll actually find information that's important to the particular scenario you're running under. But that's not it. We've got yet still more extensions. Certificate policies is a place for a issuer to put a pointer to the contract under which they issued the cert. And so you'll look at VeriSign and you'll see that they'll put URLs pointing to their 75-page certificate practice statement and a hash of their certificate practice statement. They used to not put a hash there. They used to just put a URL pointer to the document. And we kind of pointed out that that wasn't really secure because they could change the contract out from underneath people, and you know they reluctantly, you know, said, "Oh yeah, that's true."
Do all those URLs work still?
A lot of them do, for as long as the search is still valid, right? You can do amazing things with redirects.
Sure, you know? But you know sometimes one organization doesn't talk to the other, and they change their naming scheme. And,
these things get exercised enough. I think they do. Most CAs disclaim liability or really limit it. Okay, so the thing I want you to take away from this is when you build a chain, you start with this identity cert and you kind of have to discover up to the root, but then you can't verify it because you got to work back down. Because you have to sort of look at all the constraint propagation to see if the chain that you've picked actually works. So there's a lot of walking up and down the tree as you're doing chain building to figure out what's valid. And you can be constructing a chain, you can present me a chain, and it turns out that when it hits my root, there's some constraint on my root that blows your chain away, and I have to go construct a different chain. So that's why even when you think that you've constructed something valid, you don't know until you hit the policy at the other end, and the guy who's the relying party, whether or not it's going to be accepted. Okay? Now let's get into lifecycle management. And again, I'm going to blow through this kind of quick. Lifecycle management, or CLAM, as we're now starting to call it, CLM, is all about enrolling for certs, revoking certs, renewing certs, everything around sort of the life cycle of particular certs as they live and die. Okay? So enrollment is what we call the process of acquiring certs. Renewal is when your cert's about to expire, so you want to go get it renewed by the CA and pay him another $400 or whatever. And then revocation is all about undoing. So enrollment is I'm going to walk up to a CA and I go to VeriSign, I say, hi, I want to go buy a cert, and I'm going to generate a proof that I own my private key, which is something called a PKCS10 message. That's the old style message that we use. I gen a key pair, I create a message containing a copy of the key, and I sign it with the private, and I send that up to the CA, and I say, here's a request. Now, that's just a self-signed message. If the CA wants some sort of authentication from me that I am who I say I am and that it's bound to me, they're going to have to do something else, you know, to sort of add on to that. Okay? And one of your problems in your problem set in the homework is going to be about how you leverage Kerberos in that environment. But in a low environment, like if I'm just getting an S/MIME cert, they'll send me a piece of mail back and see if I can get mail at like some address, you know, things like that. We had a problem set where we did that a while back too. CA verifies my signature.
So the public key is not in the message.
Yeah, I create a message. It has the public key as the think of it as a data structure. That,
so how does the CA decrypt it then?
Well, it's not encrypted. It's just signed by me. It's just signed. So what they're able to do is they're able to read the structure, pull my public key out, verify that the signature was generated with the corresponding private key. So all they know is that it was created, you know, that the entity who sent that, you know, had a copy of it. But that's about it. Okay? This is the important one. CA verifies out of band, I am who I say I am, or they give me some challenge back and they ask me to sign it again, or you can do all sorts of different things, depending on how much they want to go do. CA creates the cert containing the ID, the way they're going to identify me, because they may have rules over how I'm named. They sign it with their key, so they've certified a binding. You know, they send that back to me, I verify the signature on it, and then either I or the CA may choose to publish and put the cert in some directory somewhere, or not, as the case may be. So in enrollment, it's very simple, right? It's basically I send up what's called a PKCS 10. This is the old style message format. That's this proof of possession. Hold me just a sec. And what comes back is a PKCS number 7, which you'll remember was the original format that we now use in S/MIME. We use an updated version called CMS in S/MIME. Question here.
Can you say a little more about out of band and how you're getting around mallet?
Okay. So what typically happens there really kind of depends on what your environment is. If I'm in an enterprise environment, I'm going to leverage something like Kerberos or some other domain, right? If I am someone like VeriSign, what you tend to do for low volume certs is they'll actually send back, so what they'll do is they'll accept the request and they'll sort of put it in a pending queue, and then they'll send you some piece of email back that's got one of these, you know, click on this link to go validate that you received this message, and it will tie it back. And then when you complete that step, just like a lot of these anti-spam filters do, and that'll sort of say, okay, yes, I was able to receive a message, and so they know that at least the key was submitted, because all they're going to do is they're going to bind the key to an email address. And all they want to check is to see if you were able to submit from an email address. There are other possibilities where you can actually trigger the enrollment as part of a web enrollment process where you browse to the website and you say, I want to go get a key, and they actually trigger key generation to happen on the client through a control that gets loaded into the browser. You can do something like that, too. But that's not going to be strong binding, right? At the end of the day, you are going to come back to, well, did you really submit this key? Well, we're going to go call you up and earn our $400 and do that sort of thing. Or they're just going to go look at where, I mean, it depends upon what they're attesting to in the cert, right? In the DoD's case, what they do when they issue the Common Access Card is you actually show up, right? And so you prove your identity with, like, your passport and something like that, and they give you a smart card, and they write the cert onto the smart card while you're there. That's what we happen to do inside of Microsoft, right? When I go get a badge, and I get a smart card issued, you know, it's a smart card badge, and there's a cert issued to it. Well, I prove my identity to the security officer, and he says, okay, I'm now going to write a cert on your card, and he fills that out, okay? And so a lot of it comes down to that. There was a plan at one point to have the U.S. Post Office actually issue certs in the same way that they are the front for INS for passport issuance, that you'd be able to go in. That kind of never took off, but other countries do that, and there are some countries, especially Sweden does this, and I think Portugal's been doing this, and a lot of countries in Europe, which are now, you know, issuing national ID cards, that have a smart card chip associated with them, and they'll issue certs. I'm sorry.
What? Belgium.
And Belgium. And Belgium's doing electronic cards.
That certainly would then pull out the smart card and use it.
You could use it, but it's tied to the key on the smart card. But you could pull the cert off the smart card and you can send it around. But the idea would be if I signed a message with the key that was on the smart card, that cert would get automatically included. Okay.
So in the case of this recent thing with the big bank in Salt Lake City,
yes,
the CA took no verification steps.
That's not quite true. What the CA verified was that there was a business that owned the domain for which they were registering the cert. The problem was that it was like the bank was like mountainbank.com,
yeah,
and the person who registered was mountain-bank.com or something like that. So they verified that the owner of the domain was a legitimate business and owned the domain, but they didn't verify the name conflict between two similar forms of what looks semantically equivalent.
So basically there's no requirement for due diligence of the CA.
That's a real interesting question, and it gets into like issues of trademark law and stuff like that, that's what the question comes down to, and what should they have done, and were they within the bounds of what they attested to or not.
But also, if the name was something more innocuous, like some other name with dashes in it that didn't have the word bank, you know, would it be need to be investigated?
Well, that's a good question. All right, I've only got half an hour, so I'm going to hold the rest of these questions, but we can talk about it afterwards. So just some more alphabet soup in case you run into it. PKCS 10s and 7s were the old standards for doing cert enrollment messages. They're still used. They got sort of superseded by a standard that's in the process of being done in IETF, which I worked on 5 or 6 years ago or more, called Certificate Management with CMS, which is, since PKCS 7 got replaced with CMS, this is sort of the update version for it. And so if you ever see CMC or if you see CMP, that's an alternative set because they have two standards because there were two competing camps for how to do cert enrollment, so you kind of got to support pieces of both. Just take a look. If you ever see that, that's what's going on there. But 10s and 7s was the old sort of standby way of doing it. All right. Let's get to revocation. How am I doing? Oh, 13 slides. Perfect. All right. All of the certs that we're concerned with have validity periods, and they expire at some point in time. Expiration dates help bind risk. Now, the thing that gets kind of odd about this is as you go up the chain in the hierarchy, you're sort of taking on more risk, right? Your root certs effectively take on more risk because they're certifying more things underneath them, and yet ironically they tend to have longer validity periods because you don't want to roll them as fast. When a cert expires, you've got to replace it with a new one, and you know, you want your chains to continue building. Sometimes it becomes necessary to undo a cert before its expiration period. Okay? So you bound the risk. If I'm VeriSign and I say I only want to sell you a cert for a year because I want you to come back every year and I only want to verify you for a 12-month period, I put a 12-month expiration in. If your key gets compromised before that, then I have to undo my signature. And the way you do that is by revoking the cert. And there's basically two common techniques for doing so. The most common case for this happening is you've lost access to the key and you need to go buy a new cert because you didn't back it up and you had some sort of machine failure, right? Or somebody breaks in and your key was stored in software as opposed to hardware and they walked off with the key. Or your cert was issued under false pretenses, so VeriSign finds out that you weren't really mountainbank.com and they decide to revoke your cert. You know, or, you know, they finally figure out that Microsoft doesn't have an office in Eastern Romania. You know. Maybe we do,
not
actually.
Not a big one.
Not an Authenticode code signing office, you know. There are two standards. Traditionally, revocation was done with something called CRILs. They were X509 V2 CRILs, or PKIX Part 1 CRILs, certificate revocation lists. These are lists of serial numbers that are no longer valid, okay? And you pushed CRILs around, and that's what you did. You know, when you got a cert, you went out and you found the CRIL from the issuer, and you checked to see if the cert you were looking at was on the hot list, was on the CRIL. The newer standard for doing this is an online check, because everyone's online. They realize that pushing around large amounts of revocation information about certs you didn't care about didn't really make a lot of bandwidth sense. And so instead, you do status checks. And that's what OCSP is about. It's getting a little status check. So I go and say, okay, I've got a cert. Let me go get a real-time freshness statement to see if it's still okay. Both methods are about whether a cert's been revoked, why it's been revoked, and the time it was revoked. And all three of these are important, because a cert getting revoked because the credit card you used to pay VeriSign failed to validate and so they didn't get their money is kind of different from you committed fraud and they're undoing their binding of you because you just got hold off to lender. Okay? So the reason behind revocation, and sometimes and certs can actually be temporarily suspended on a CRIL and then come off the suspension list. And there's all this sort of stuff that makes it very kind of complicated. CAs revoke certs by taking the serial number of the cert and putting it on the CRIL. CRILs are like antimatter. When they come into contact with a cert, the two blow up. A CRIL stays around, but the cert just dies at that point on your machine. Okay? Doesn't die everywhere else. So the CRILs got to get around to wherever people need it. How many of you remember the hot lists from 1970s and credit cards? Okay, some, thank God some people do, okay? For those of you who don't, it used to be the case years ago. Every week, the credit card company would send out a really thick book of very thin paper with very small numbers on it that were all the credit cards that had been revoked, that were no longer valid. This was before they had online validation. And you'd go and you'd check out and you'd use your credit card and they'd page through to see if your card was listed on there or not. And they put out a list every week. That was a CRIL. It was a CRIL for Visa and MasterCard. And that is exactly the system that exists and is still in use for most of revocation today. It was a hot list.
A new book every week.
And they do a new book every week. And at some point, they probably did Deltas where they did updates when we have Delta CRILs too and that sort of thing. But basically, they put a book out. Actually, I don't think they did that. I think I always saw it as it was one big fat book that they just printed. And you just paged through it and you looked it up by number to see if the number was valid or not. When they went to online validation, right, it saved them. I mean, part of the way in which the credit card companies got the merchants to buy into the whole online scheme was they gave them a better rate on the credit card transaction, right? And they basically subsidized the equipment and basically gave them a quarter point or an eighth of a point discount because it changed their risk model completely. Because once you publish that CRIL, you've committed to what's good and what's bad for the period that that's valid, okay?
The CRIL itself is a cert.
The book itself is a cert. It's a cert of what's bad. And if it's not, and it's valid unless you hear something telling you it's not. Okay? That's, so if it's not on the CRIL, it's a good cert and you can believe it. Okay.
Isn't there more than one way of doing CRILs? Like, even though maybe in practice we do it a sweet one, I've heard of some people who advocate just putting all the good certs on the list.
You could, The problem with that in practice is that there tend to be more good certs than bad certs.
Uh-huh.
Okay? And certs have to stay on the CRILs for as long as their validity period sits around. So you could do something like that, but, you know, if when you want work the mechanics out, well, neither of them are ideal, okay? And it really kind of depends on how often you expect things to turn over. If you expect that 1% of the people per month are going to lose their keys and going to have their certs revoked, you want to put the bad ones on the CRIL. If 10% of the people are going to get their certs revoked per day because you assign that to, like, badges to get into the building, and every time you got to print them a temporary badge, you roll their keys or something, then that changes the dynamics, okay? The big problem with all of these blacklists, which is what all of what CRIL is, they're not issued frequently enough to really protect against serious risk or high-value transactions. They're really expensive, and they're subject to DOS attacks, right? So if you can stop, you can block access to the CRIL, you block access to the revocation information. Or if you can swap an old CRIL in. So there's a question, well, how do you know if your CRIL's fresh enough? Well, your CRIL has a freshness date in it. Well, what happens if your CRIL has expired? Do you no longer use that CRIL, or if you can't get a new one? Do you trust it as the best available information? What's your policy and what's your risk model on it? And all of these things end up impacting how you accept stuff or not.
Is the CRL signed?
It is signed. It's signed by the issuer. And in the original model, it had to be signed by the issuer who issued the cert. We've now gotten a little bit more complicated where you're allowed to delegate your CRIL ability to third parties. There were actually companies that tried to form a business about 5, 6, 7 years ago of aggregating CRIL information from a whole bunch of CAs. But I'll talk about it a little bit later. The CRIL information is actually more valuable than the cert information. Okay? At the time at which you're conducting a high-value financial transaction, the thing you want to know is that the certs that are presented are fresh right now. And that revocation information is much more valid. When you swipe a credit card through and it does an online validation, there's a risk transference that occurs there. And it's a different type of risk transference if I do an online validate with a credit card versus I do an offline, take an imprint and do it later. Right? There's this whole notion of card present versus card absent in the credit card business. And it's all about when's the risk move around. Okay? And so that's a long-winded way of kind of answering your question, but it really, they can do that, but it varies. Okay? Here's another real problem with CRILs. CRILs can retroactively revoke certs. It is possible to issue a CRIL today, and so I can have the following situation. I get a cert at the 1st of January. CRIL comes out every 2 weeks. Okay, my cert goes bad on January 15th, but the CRIL that comes out on the 15th says it's good. The CRIL that comes out on the 30th says it's good. You depend upon my cert on February 1st, it's all well and good. I report my key got compromised on some later point in time, and it gets revoked as of February 15th, and it gets backdated. So at later points in time, a CRIL can come out and can invalidate a cert back past previous CRIL issuance dates, which can therefore invalidate transactions which, at the time at which you made them, were made upon the best information you had available and which were valid. Okay? Did you guys follow that? Did you see the craziness going on there, right? Okay. So, you know, it's not sufficient to check at a time that you know that it was valid at the time. You got to kind of protect yourself and say, here's the information that I depend, that I made my decision on, and at some later point in time, all of that can become invalid. Plus, if the CA goes bad, the CRILs can become invalid, and then I'm really kind of in trouble. Because then, you know, who knows what happens. So, oh, I actually just screwed in the slides. I didn't realize I did that. okay, but yeah, they can't change the rules out from under you. Question here, go ahead.
So, this aspect of the CRIL...
Sorry about that, I forgot to use that.
So this aspect of the CRIL, then you can't doubt the validity of any transaction that you make in time team. Because you never know when in the future this might be retroactive.
That's correct. So the problem, that's an absolute true. At the time at which you make a decision, at the end of the day, you have no absolute guarantee. You are making, under this system, you're making a relative risk. Okay, so, but you know, it's narrowing the risk down. So let's walk through this narrow. If you come up to me and say, I want to buy something, and you give me a cert for it, and I don't do any revocation checking, well, there's some risk that that's going to go bad. If I do some revocation checking and it turns out the only CRIL I can find is 30 days old, well, my risk has been reduced somewhat because I know your cert was good according to them up to 30 days ago, but I don't know. if I get a quilt from 2 days ago, that tells me more. If after we have the conversation and we do whatever, I keep checking krills, you know, it's possible at some later point in time, yeah, it turns out your thing was bad and you spoofed me. But that's kind of the best I can do. Okay? Question in the back here.
I mean, as a practical matter, do you just simply then check krills for the rest of your life against all your previous transactions? Or?
No, as a practical matter, you probably just ignore it and it's part of the whole fraud model. And you got to understand that everything's about risk transference, right? And like, when you look at the credit card model and understand that they assume that there's sort of, you know, this small fraud stuff that's going to happen constantly, they just build it into the model. It's part of the 3% that they take from the merchants, right? You know, I used to work at AT&T, right? And the fact is, in the long distance calls, there's a certain percentage of fraud that happens, okay? And being able to reduce the fraud rate by 0.1% paid for all of AT&T research for like a year. Okay, because there was that, and even, you know, because that was the size of numbers we were talking about. And you assume that, you just account for that in the system. But you can be paranoid, you know, you can, but it's not clear, even if you knew that it got revoked at a later date, how much you'd be able to do. It might save you if you got hauled into court, right? Because if it turns out that 6 months down the road someone sues you, you can say, well, look, here's the information I depended upon, and I made my decision in accordance with my policies, which were all correct based on the best information, you know, and there was no fraud on my part in agreeing to this transaction. I was good with it just like you were. But that's kind of what it boils down to. And it's all about risk transference at the end of the day, okay? So, you know, we do the best we can. You could be paranoid on it, but that's why folks have kind of decided that these krill things don't make as much sense as, tell me what you know about this thing now. Okay, as opposed to, tell me what you knew about it a week ago, and by the way, you reserve the right to a week from now say that I made a, that my evidence was bad, that what I made a decision on. Okay? It gets worse if you try to revoke an intermediate CA cert. Because if you revoke an intermediate cert, you are potentially invalidating the entire chain underneath it. Okay? Now, again, this kind of depends on what your acceptance policy is. If you think of it simply from a tree hierarchy and you knock out a cert in the middle, you've now got this detached subtree just hanging loose there, which you might be able to reattach if you issued a new cert with the appropriate same names and that sort of thing, so it would chain for the CA. But if the key's compromised with the CA, if it's not just some other sort of revocation, then all of the certs it issued may be suspect, and you may not be able to recover back from that. And so, depending on your chaining logic and such, you may just be in a situation where if you knock out an intermediate CA, you've got to recertify everybody underneath it, and based on how high up that was. Which comes back to some of the questions, which is, well, what happens if a root or some high thing gets lost or gets compromised? And that's why those keys are protected pretty well, because they can have catastrophic results for the CAs that are in the business. That's what you're in the business in. At the end of the day, if you're a CA, you're in the business of protecting your private key material and doing due diligence on the certs you issue. And if you lose access to your private key or your key gets compromised, well, that's kind of like the bank vault getting cracked, you know? Now, someone asked earlier, how do I revoke a self-signed cert? Well, the cert kind of revokes itself. I mean, so logically, here's what happens. The cert has a signature on it, which is from itself. It puts out a krill, which it signs itself, saying its cert is no longer valid.
Why do I have a self-signed cert again?
Because you need a carrier for the root key.
Okay.
Basically. Okay? So, well, do I accept the krill and bounce the cert? Well, once I do that, the cert's no longer valid, so the signature on the krill's no longer valid, so I'm kind of looped. So it kind of breaks down at that point, okay? Self-signed certs basically have to be, the roots have to be dealt with separately, because it's the trust policy. Just you can't do anything automated there, okay? Or if you do, it's got to be out of band, and you're adding another level of hierarchy in. You can't revoke krills. Krills have issue times, and they have next update times, which is the time at which the next update to the krill is expected to be available. But you can't undo a krill. So once you commit to a krill, you are at that point in time, and basically until the next update, committing to a statement of what's bad within your domain. And if I get a krill that is issued today and says it's got a validity, that its next update is 2 weeks away, I can reliably rely on that CRL for the next 2 weeks without downloading a new one.
But a CRL is a cert, so you can't revoke the cert on that.
Well, it's not a, no, it's a different format. It's not a cert structure. It's a different format. So there's no way of actually revoking the signature on a CRL. You need a CRL for CRLs, and it doesn't exist. Okay? So if I put out I can put a new CRL out early. You know, if I learn tomorrow your cert's invalid, I can put a new CRL out with your cert listed on it. But clients don't have to pick it up if they picked up the one today, because as far as I've committed to, it's good for 2 weeks. So now you get into an engineering process, which is how often do I refresh my CRLs, which is how do I limit my liability and what's my risk model, versus how much bandwidth are people going to consume downloading CRLs over and over again when they probably don't depend on most of this. If every time I go out and I go hit an SSL website, I got to go download a CRL from VeriSign, and that CRL is 300 to 700K, and they decide to publish it every day, well, that's a bunch of bandwidth I'm going to go consume. Not a big deal if I'm in a broadband scenario, but imagine what I'm doing over a 9600 baud modem or something like that if I'm down the, you know, at that kind of speed. And that becomes a real issue. So that prompted something called OCSP, which was an online status checking service. And the notion, the difference here is between aggregation, creating a one statement that says everything that's bad under the scope of the CA, versus small, easily generatable freshness certs. Okay? CRLs combine revocation information for the CA. OCSP responses are designed to be real-time generated or short duration. Tell me if it's good now. Tell me if it's good at this point in time. They're both generated by the issuing CA, generally not the party that's depending on them, but OCSP is more designed for the go out and issue the HTTP and go say, give me back a response for the cert I'm interested in right now. So you get back a signed statement. You can actually get back both a signed or an unsigned variant, but generally let's say it's a signed statement that says, yes, the cert was good at time T, either time T you asked or time T in the recent past, but you get back sort of a one-element CRL. Okay? These can be generated ahead of time or on a frequent basis. They can be handed out. They can be real-time generated. You can think of it like a freshness cert. It basically says, oh, yeah, that cert that he got from VeriSign 6.8, yeah, it's still good. You know, you can still drink the milk. It's okay. You know, the cert's still good. And we really needed it because as we started turning on revocation, we were passing too much around, right? The CRLs were getting too big and we're consuming too much bandwidth, okay? And there's a problem on your homework about that, too. What tends to happen is if I'm an end entity, the first thing I do, step one, I go out and I request a cert from a CA, and he hands me that cert back. And now in step three, I go and I send to the relying party, like an SSL server, the cert with some transaction. Before he accepts it, there is a request that sends the cert along to the CA. So the cert goes along here, and the CA, and when the relying party asks the CA, is that cert still fresh? And in step five, the CA says, yeah, it's still good. And so the relying party says, okay, I'll do your transaction because I've now received proof. There's actually some discussion now of modifying the SSL protocol to allow servers to staple in OCSP responses as part of the way when they send the server cert. So that a server, when it sends information to the client, sends its cert, and it staples in a fresh OCSP response from the CA at the same time, so that the client sort of has the freshest information and doesn't have to do a separate query. Just as another interesting observation. And I mentioned this earlier, from a financial standpoint, it's the revocation information that's the valuable stuff, not the issued cert itself. For high-value transactions, you want to know the cert's good right now, and that's where your value is. Just like credit cards want to know that the credit card's good right now. And we talked through that before, so I'll kind of leave that. Most certs don't require any sort of directory. Most of the protocols these days send chains along. If you're in an enterprise, you can do lots of directory queries. But you tend to send these chains in things like SSL TLS, logon, things for that. When you are mapping back into your enterprise authorizations, authentication authorization system, there's some cert mapping rule. So there's a way of taking fields out of a cert and converting it back into whatever account system you've got inside. And that's going to vary on the basis of whatever, you know, your account system looks like. And there's a whole bunch of stuff you can do there that becomes interesting based on what your system is. You could be setting up some system that's using, say, S/MIME going back and forth, where you take information out of the certs and mapped it into some business process thing because you knew how the certs were created. Signing operations tend to embed certs in the signature. There's part of that in just in the PKCS7 structure. And then the final thing I kind of want, well, actually, there's two more slides, but everything that I've talked about tonight in terms of X509 and PKIX is the basic structure. When you actually go out and look at any of the protocols that build on top of it, they all write profiles of PKIX. So if you go look at TLS, TLS will profile PKIX and say, yeah, here's all the options that PKIX says could possibly appear in the certs. These are what our certs look like. In IPsec, these are what IPsec certs look like. These are what WPA, WPA2 certs look like. These are what S/MIME certs look like. Every sort of protocol that ends up building on top of the PKI structure says, okay, look, there's all these options out there, but we don't really need them for our scenario. So they profile the certs down. If you get into an engineering problem where you are going to build on top of certs for doing some sort of authentication, you get to play the same trick. And you can say, you know, PKIX is great, X509 gives me all these options, but here's the way our certs are going to look like. And this is what the certs we're going to issue, this is the information we're going to put into our names, these are the types of proprietary extensions we're going to add, and this is the profile of what our certs are going to look like in our world. And you can use that to your advantage. You don't have to support, and there's some options that have to be supported by the standard, but a lot of this is optional, and you can pick and choose for what's the most appropriate for your problem. CAs define profiles, orgs define profiles. As I mentioned earlier, the DoD in issuing these common access cards to soldiers defined a profile for what was going to go in the certs and what couldn't go in the certs and what those were going to look like. And then you can custom craft software to sort of understand that. And I will end on just some additional things to think about. Publishing certs. Certs may be public or not. You can choose how to publish them, where to publish them, what format to do so. Key escrow. Okay. One of the problems on the homework is going to be about, so imagine that you're enrolling and you've got you're in a corporation, you've got a signature key and an encryption key for mail. And policy is that we'll give you certs on both of those, but you have to escrow the encryption key in case you get hit by that crosstown beer truck and they need access to your mail. Okay, and you can actually tie in the escrow as part of the enrollment process. So you'll investigate how to do that. Auto-enrollment is another interesting thing, right? The big problem turns out to be provisioning of certs. That's what everyone's kind of going after. We've kind of got all the mechanisms in place. How do you enroll 100,000 people? How do you leverage whatever authentication system you've got? We'll look at that too. Establishing trusts and hierarchies. How do you cross-certify? How do you decide what pieces of two large PKI organizations should trust each other and what the process is? So you really got to think that through because there's the law of unintended consequences plays here. You know, you don't just cross-certify the roots and assume everything's golden because that's probably not what you want in a lot of these cases. CA private keys. Your private keys have to be protected, of course, but the CA private keys doubly so. I will run screaming out of the room if a CA tells me that they've got their keys in software. There is no reason for a CA. If you are ever installing a CA or putting a CA in, I expect all of you as graduates of this class to have hardware crypto modules holding those keys. Keys should never be in software. I don't care how they're cheap enough these days. You can put a hardware card in. It can be, you know, smart card thing. What the real CAs do is the roots are all offline in closets in secured vaults, and they're never basically used for anything but certifying intermediates, and even those intermediates may not be online directly, and you'll have, you know, sort of a hierarchy in there. That's what we do, and that's sort of the best practice that a lot of companies do these days. Their roots are just, you know, maybe a key storage device that's just in the vault somewhere and has to be brought out and hooked up to a machine in order to sign anything. And then disseminating root certs, again, traditionally that happens as part these days of some enterprise policy update, if you're in an enterprise. If you are dealing with your customers, the big problem is if you're like a bank and you wanted your customers to install root certs, you're not going to get your customers to install roots, right? You need some way to basically leverage the infrastructure that's out there, or you do it automatically. Because you know, it's just it's too far out of what the typical user experiences. All right, I've run a few minutes over, and I went fast through the end of it, but I thank you for your attention. Problem set will go up later tonight, early in the morning, when I get it generated in the PDF. And I will send mail out to the list when that's done. So please remember to send us, if you haven't done so already, because in the first half hour I got about 4 or 5 votes already. So from those of you who weren't online in class, you can send us your preferred pairs of location and days for doing your talks. And I've sent mail out to the list with what we're looking for, so if you forgot what the days are, it's all there in email. And otherwise, have a good evening, and thank you.